Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Childcare can rival a mortgage or rent in California, a financial burden that is further weighed down by the reality that there is a shortage of available spaces. Kids Data is a nonprofit that tracks childcare costs and availability. Statewide, the average cost for a childcare center is just under $1,500 a month, but that number is from 2018. The pandemic further strained what was already a difficult or unaffordable option for working households. A poll conducted by Valley Vision in partnership with CAP Radio surveyed residents across a six-county region, Sacramento, Sutter, Yuba, Yolo, Placer, and El Dorado counties. It found about a third of parents say they don't have access to the child care that they need. That number jumps when broken down by race and ethnicity. Srishti Prabha is CAP Radio's education reporter and spent time understanding the why, as well as sharing the voices and lived experiences behind this data. Srishti, good morning.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you. Surveys like Valley Vision are really just a springboard to better understand the challenges and concerns that people often face in private with conversations with loved ones. When you first took a look at this data honing in on childcare, what stood out to you about the findings?
So, yeah, Valley Vision had actually conducted this survey with multiple education-related questions. So, initially, the data is kind of overwhelming and unclear. They ask questions about after-school activities and educational resources. So, when I was looking at the data, there was just a lot of numbers, a lot of demographics to look at. But I honed in on childcare because the percentage variation was really high between racial demographics and between incomes in households.
Childcare in and of itself is such a big topic to cover. You can go in so many directions with it. How did the survey's findings shape how you were going to approach and really tackle your reporting?
Well, I think one part of my reporting is always delving into race and equity. So I really wanted to do reporting that, you know, provides equitable access to all parents. And so, yeah, I already saw when I was looking at this data that childcare access was affecting all parents in the greater Sacramento area. And what I found was that only 22.5% of parents in the area felt confident in their access. So then delving a little further into the race and equity portion of childcare felt like a particularly strong angle. I found that around 90% of Black parents were reporting lack of confidence, followed by Latin parents. And then there was this other category that was almost non-denominational. I don't know if it was mixed, if it was just other minorities, but they indicated very high levels of inaccessibility, which makes me believe that lack of access is even higher in minority populations that were being underrepresented. And then just the last portion of this was even taking a look at the socioeconomic stratas that played a role. So if you had just enough money and one were unable to access services from the county, you wouldn't be able to get those services. So that became an added stressor.
Yeah, there's so many intersections with this. Starting with the big picture, the survey was conducted at a time when families are still very much recovering from the sacrifices that they made during the pandemic. How is childcare different now compared to prior to the pandemic, prior to 2020?
Yeah, that's a really important thing to talk about, what happened prior to 2020 and what's happening now, because we lost 4,300 childcare spots because of the pandemic, and these childcare centers were closing because they weren't getting enough people coming to their centers because of COVID. So it was a loss of spaces, and we haven't built up at the same rate as we lost those childcare spaces. And so only 28% of parents that require childcare access have it in Sacramento County. And that number is 26% in all over California. So it's just a meager amount in the whole state. And you kind of mentioned this at the beginning that, you know, we're surpassing housing costs. That's real. The amount that you're paying for childcare is more than your housing. So the California report card, which is a report card informing public policy and things for childcare, they gave California a D+ when it comes to childcare. So that tells you where we're at, actually, at this point in terms of access.
Yeah, especially when just roughly a quarter of families actually have the access to childcare that they need. So with all of that context, how do people respond to the questions surrounding access to childcare? There's an overall number, but as you mentioned, you also break it down by demographics for a clearer picture.
Definitely. So I said that there was this other group that was kind of non-denominational. 92% of those parents reported not feeling confident in their access. Then we had 90% of Black parents that felt unsure. I mentioned that earlier. 87% of Latin parents. So that's not that far behind. And then you have, when you break it down by income, you have 91% of parents that are making under 50K that are unsure about their access, and 86% of parents making between 50 and 150K that are unsure. So even in that middle income group where you maybe might think that, oh, they might not have these other stressors, it's still a stressor. So yeah.
Yeah, of course. I mean, rents are going up, housing prices are going up. And when you're talking about child care, that on average, just, and this is back in 2018, that is $1,500 a month. I mean, that really rivals mortgage or rent. So when getting to the why, and that's really the important question here, you started your piece with Raina Jones, a single mother from Sacramento's Oak Park neighborhood. How did you come to meet her?
Yeah, honestly, a lot of journalism is asking around. So I started trying to find out what the county was doing. And through that, there's this organization called First Five Sacramento, which if you're in the education sphere, you might be aware of. They do community intervention and public policy for education and child care. And so through them, I kind of got connected to different programs that are available. And Raina was one of those people who had been very much advocating for her lack of access and was informing changes for her community. So I thought she was just such a strong voice because, I mean, childcare is, it's intersectional. And, you know, she talked about how as a young Black single mother, she was also struggling with mental health. And, you know, she had an early pregnancy. She dealt with postpartum depression. She was adopted. She was a victim of partner abuse. So, I mean, I think she had a lot of things that were going on. And I think we should hear from her a little bit.
And so when I went to my 8-week appointment, I was like, well, you know, like, I'm really anxious. I don't think I'm ready to go back to work. And like, go back to work. And I'm just like, working for a program that's for parents and having postpartum depression. So I'm flying even more under the radar because it's not something that people think about. And so childcare was basically when I was working. So I would get up with the kid, take her to school, you know, get off of work 10 minutes to get to the daycare before they closed. And then we go home. And so it was like that. It was constant, like that same pattern. And I think that's kind of what broke me in the beginning.
So, yeah, she was trying to fulfill her duties as a mother, but then also having to work because there's no other way to sustain, you know, a household. And then there was the added complexity of her having an ongoing mental health challenge, which was exacerbated, which actually ended up, you know, causing her to leave her full-time job.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to take care of others when you can't even take care of yourself, right? There were other mothers you met as well. It wasn't just Raina. They all have unique lived experiences, but they do face similar challenges. Who else did you meet along the way?
Yeah, I also spoke to another single mother who was also Black and had been separated from her husband while she was pregnant last year with her second child. And her name was Andrea Foster. She actually works for the state government and makes a relatively good income. But, you know, there were all these added layers to why she was having difficulty making ends meet, and she sought county services. And this is what she told me.
Like, I was trying to reach out, you know, to the county through supportive services and things like that, trying to see if I qualified for any, like, child care assistance, because daycare is extremely expensive. And, so I don't have much family at all. I was raised in foster care, so it's kind of like I've just, like, created my own family. So the family that I do have, they were working, and it was really hard to find child care. They make it really difficult for people who are not like extremely poor to receive childcare. Mm-hmm. So what I was finding was that if my income was anything over $1,400 a month for a 3-person household, me, my daughter and my son, anything over $1,400, I wouldn't qualify for any sort of, you know, child, any sort of aid at all, actually.
So if you think about it, $1,400 is probably what you're paying on average for rent. And then she's saying that if you make anything over $1,400, that's the only way you can qualify. But, I mean, you shouldn't have to make so little to qualify for these services, because even somebody making double that amount can't afford.
Right.
Because if you have to pay for food or you have to pay for other things. So, you know, inevitably she did not qualify. And then she was put on a 3-year waiting list by Child Action, Inc., which is a nonprofit partnered with the state's Department of Social Service and Child Care. And they try to provide affordable and quality services, and they are trying their best, but with the need, they're not able to meet that demand.
Yeah. I mean, just listening briefly to Reyna and Andrea, like, it really just deepens our understanding of the layers of challenges. How did it shape your understanding when it comes to the strain of access to child care?
Yeah, what I realized was both Andrea and Reyna were at these crossroads of all these different determinants. You have race, you have economic stability, you have education, you have housing, you have familial structures, and all of them can kind of act as barriers to access. And I think one of the main things that I wanted to point out is that, you know, you don't need to be in these dire situations to require help and seek help. And so one of the things that the program director of Sacramento Crisis Nursery, Rachel Hahn, told me was that those seeking the space were actually not people that you would, you know, think were in crisis, but there were things that were happening that you might not actually realize. So there was this underbelly of parents coming in that needed support but weren't necessarily unemployed. And so this is what she had to say.
We do see a fair amount of employment, but it's not just employment. There's secondary things happening in the household that are causing additional stress onto the family.
So I want to talk a little bit about Sacramento Crisis Nursery, because we just heard from Rachel. They provide affordable child care for people in crisis. So their organization is only 2 out of 5 in the whole state that does this holistic approach. Basically, they're open 24/7, 365 days a year. And the point is to mitigate child abuse and neglect by dedicating a caseworker to every parent that walks through their space. And I emphasize it being open all the time, because a lot of times parents might be working non-traditional jobs. They might be facing, lack of support. You know, there's a lot of reasons why someone might need to access childcare at different points in time. So one thing that I thought was interesting was that Sacramento Crisis Nursery and Child Action, Inc., both Sacramento-based, delved into the demographics of those seeking their data. And they discovered that in the last year, their most frequent visitors were Black children, followed closely by Latin children. And so Han was saying that in response to this data, they were trying to increase the number of dual language speakers at their sites and just more representation on site.
Yeah, Sacramento is an incredibly diverse community. Ultimately, how does the lack of childcare, because you are an education reporter, how does the lack of childcare coupled with the pandemic impact learning and education?
Yeah, it for many children of color, lack of access has far-reaching implications. The intersection of race and access to childcare amplifies the achievement gap that already exists. And a lot of times we think, oh, this achievement gap kind of started to occur during the pandemic, but actually it predates online learning. 2018-2019 school year, we found that 27% of Sacramento's Black children were meeting math and literacy standards, and that number only dropped by 2% post-pandemic. So that is already a pre-existing issue. And then we know that early childhood development is important for closing this gap and requires culturally competent care. So Reyna talks a little bit about this for her daughter.
She actually had a teacher who was African-American. I have to say that because I feel like it really helped my daughter. She's biracial, but she's more likely to listen to a woman of color who's Black and has that strong female presence in her life. And so for her, it was her teacher became more of like an aunt or a friend for us as a family. And it was really important to me because I felt really alone, and I was going through postpartum depression really bad, and I didn't know what it was.
Yeah, that's just one example of teachers going beyond a classroom. I mean, there's a collective awareness that there's a problem. Are there promising solutions, though, taking shape?
Yes, yes. I spoke to Janine Cooper, who is running the childcare program for the city of Sacramento, and she said equitable access was a driver in their conversation regarding the distribution of funds received by the American Rescue Plan Act for childcare. So with the funding received, she says the government can implement a childcare provider stipend program to sustain existing businesses and open new ones. So any childcare providers listening out there, there will be a stipend, or there might already be a stipend in the process for you. And if you want to be a child care provider, because they're trying to increase provider access, there is a stipend for that as well. And to bolster community-driven childcare services, they're honing in on certain zip codes. So those are Lemon Hill, Arden Arcade, and Del Paso Heights. And there will be others that require additional support. And then these efforts are also complemented by an allocation of funds to fully support students in Sacramento who are interested in childcare work. So if you need money for education to become a childcare provider or open your own business, they're literally setting aside funds for people to do that. So definitely look into the city of Sacramento's work or read my article, because I think I linked this information. Yeah,
we do have it on our Insight page. And of course, it's on capradio.org. Finally, what do you want listeners to take away from this conversation? The bigger picture.
Right. There are still 82,000 children and students in Sacramento County that require services. And so all these programs that are going to be in progress need to be executed pretty swiftly. I think a few considerations that I thought of were access to childcare should be a right, because it really has, you know, it has an impact on the future of a kid. I think disadvantaged communities are pushed into this reproducible cycle, because if they're not getting access, then the achievement gap continues to exist, and you just have to work 10 times harder to get there. And providers should be collaborating with schools, since schools don't have the capacity. And that is something Janine Cooper is very actively doing. She said that she is trying to collaborate with schools and providers to bridge that gap a little bit and allow, you know, every student to have community specific services available to them. So if you're looking for any local organizations and you need care now, look into Child Action, Beanstalk, and Sacramento Crisis Nursery. And unfortunately, there aren't that many spots, so really we have to fill that need quite quickly.
Srishti Prabha is Cap Radio Sacramento Education Reporter. Thank you so much for joining us, Srishti.
Thank you, Vicky.
Up next, a conversation with Stockton's new police chief, Stanley McFadden. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Stockton has been on edge in recent weeks. Police are searching for who they believe is a serial shooter, killing six people in the past year and a half and injuring another victim who survived. The shootings were recently linked through ballistics analysis. Police are not saying that the shootings are race-related, but there is a common theme. The shootings are happening late at night in isolated areas. Four of the victims appear to be of Hispanic descent, and and some were also experiencing homelessness. So far, police have shared a grainy security camera video of a person of interest. All of this as Stockton's new police chief settles into his new role, having come over from the San Jose Police Department. So with that, Chief Stanley McFadden joins us now from Stockton. Welcome to Insight, Chief McFadden.
Hi, B. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's just start off with getting up to speed on the latest into a serial shooter investigation. We understand your department is getting a lot of tips, but anything that you can share that wouldn't jeopardize the investigation?
You know, we are receiving a lot of tips. The community's been great. You know, they've been very active. Even before the rewards were announced, you know, the community was very proactive and wanting to help us any way they can. We received a lot of videos, a lot of tips that we're trying to get through. You know, we're working with our local, state, and federal partners, and we're still at that same thing. You know, we would like to get that person identified. You know, we keep seeing this person, or whether it's a series of people. You know, we keep seeing something similar to that at some of the scenes. You know, we have both the ballistic evidence that leaked the gun to the scenes, and then we have some scenes where we're seeing this person of interest.
Right, because that ballistics analysis linked shootings that span about a year and a half. I mean, they started back in as early as 2021. The first one was in Oakland, and the rest have taken place in Stockton. Was that really the crucial piece to really kind of have this big development after a year and a half of deadly shootings?
Yeah, you know, they had the Oakland case, and then we had our incident last year that we have a surviving victim from. And, you know, what we know is the same gun has been at all these scenes. You know, the gun went underground for over 400 days. So, you know, at that point, we can't truly say that whoever did the shootings last year is that person that is also using that same gun. You know, we just don't know. And this is where we need to just lean on folks that know something to help us out.
You did release some video, surveillance video of a person of interest. And it's kind of hard to make out the person. I believe they're wearing like a sweater and pants and their face is kind of concealed. Can you describe what was captured on the camera? What do you want the public to see when they take in this surveillance image? Because that's really the only image that has been publicly released.
It is. So we really want the community to see how, you know, this person is in the shadows. You know, they're along the walls. They're walking through apartment complexes as, you know, they leave the scene. You know, they're wearing all dark clothing. You know, we've had some indication where they may have a black COVID mask on. But, you know, this person is under layers of clothing and lurks in the darkness, you know, which makes it hard for any video footage, you know, to really show a clear picture.
Yeah. Given all the uncertainty, and there's an understandable concern, collective concern throughout the community, especially since these are taking place late at night when people are alone, what is your department doing in terms of outreach? Are there extra patrols just to help calm residents?
Absolutely. You know, we held a town hall last week where we addressed some of these concerns, and we spoke about how not to be a victim. You know, is things we've always said, not just because, you know, we have this going on, but we've always said, you know, don't put yourself in a position where you raise the likelihood of falling victim of a violent crime or anything else. You know, we've adjusted our special operations units, and they're now working all through the night. It is very important that we try to be as visible as we can and trying to be in some of these locations where it fits the pattern of what's been occurring. We've also been passing out flyers in both Spanish and English just to encourage people to come forward, and if they have any information. Also, it talks more about how they can be saved, how they cannot be a victim, and we're going to continue these efforts as well.
Given that this is serial shootings, and there is believed to be at least one person connected to this, are there certain characteristics that investigators focus on for an investigation like this?
Yeah, well, on this, we partner with our state and federal partners, you know, when it starts to get into profiling and stuff. Right now, we just don't have a whole lot because we haven't had witnesses to really give us any information to lead us to determine what type of person we may be dealing with here. You know, we feel it's someone who's very calculating, very methodical, and is really going through a lot of measures to, you know, cover up the steps that they're doing before and after.
A recent interview with the victim who actually was shot multiple times and survived, her name is Natasha Latour. She's criticized Stockton Police Department's investigation in an interview with 209 Times. She says that she was experiencing homelessness at the time and police thought it was a drug deal gone bad, didn't take her seriously. This happened back in April of 2021, so more than a year ago. She believes had they listened, it could have saved lives. You weren't with Stockton Police then because this happened over a year ago. But with nearly 30 years experience with San Jose Police Department, a big city with a large unhoused population, a vulnerable population where typically there is stigma attached to this population. What is your response to what she's saying?
Well, you know, that's something I bring over from San Jose is there. I was a deputy chief over there over field operations with would be responsible for the outreach, you know, to our underserved communities as well as in our encampment areas and other areas where, you know, we encounter homeless. And something I've always messaged there back then, and I'll continue to message, is that I'm everyone's chief. You know, I my job is to be accessible and responsive to everyone. And it's concerning if that's her perception. I have reached out to her to connect with her. Of course, you know, we are going through all those cases and having follow-up interviews and stuff with her, and we'll continue to partner with her as far as we move forward.
Finally, how much is the reward as of today, and how effective are rewards in your experience?
The rewards are up to $125,000, and, you know, they are effective. You know, we're hearing about people even taking a break from their workplace just to, you know, take part of this. You know, $125,000 could be very life-changing to some individuals. And, you know, the city and Crime Stoppers have been great. We've had some small business owners that have also met the challenge and have also up the rewards as well. So, you know, it's a passionate community. You know, where there's trauma, there's strength. Everyone has come together and we're all working together on this.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio, and we're speaking with Stanley McFadden, who is Stockton's new police chief. Okay, so you were sworn in a little over 4 months ago on June 2nd. You took over for Chief Eric Jones, spent his entire career with Stockton Police, basically. You come from Stockton with nearly three decades of experience with San Jose Police Department. What drew you to Stockton, and what really is a new chapter for you?
You know, I've had a very blessed and fortunate career, you know, with the San Jose Police Department. And during my time at San Jose Police Department, I've been coaching athletics in Stockton. So I've always been connected with the youth in Stockton. And it just felt like a calling when the job was announced. It just felt like a calling for me to, you know, to be here. You know, I knew there were some concerns with morale being low and crime, but those are things I've always been very comfortable with, and I'm just happy at the opportunity.
Did you move to Stockton or San Joaquin County rather, like,
yes,
20
I'm
years ago? So you're a San Joaquin County resident, a long one, and you would commute to San Jose.
That's true.
Great. So you've been a long time resident here. What did you hear about Stockton while in San Jose, however, and in terms of law enforcement and in terms of policing, and has anything changed your mind about Stockton since you've actually, now you're in the position, you're within the department, you've taken over as chief?
You know, as you know, crime, it crosses a lot of lines, you know, as far as boundaries and jurisdictions. And even back in San Jose, you know, I would push my specialized units would come out to Stockton to develop on cases that we knew our suspects were in Stockton. And just the level of professionalism was always messaged to me. Even when I got into the process for Stockton, you know, my San Jose officers and command staff would tell me about the good working relationships they've had with Stockton Police Department, the incredible amount of expertise in the department. And that's what I've seen since I've been here. You know, some incredible men and women in this department that are very passionate. You know, like San Jose, Stockton's very lean, you know, when it's compared to other agencies and, you know, the populations they serve. But, you know, when you're lean, you have to be better. You have to be more effective. You have to lean on each other more. And I think Stockton Police Department does an incredible job at doing that.
Are there key differences between San Jose and Stockton?
What I notice about Stockton is a lot of generations, a lot of Stocktonians for going back over 100 years, just a lot of Stocktonians. So the roots run very deep. You know, San Jose is, there are generations there, but it's a lot of transition in San Jose. A lot of folks come in for big business and engineering and stuff to where they're not as deeply connected within the, you know, the areas of San Jose.
You are the first African-American police chief in the city of Stockton's history. I've had these discussions in the past with former Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn and recently with Sacramento County Sheriff-elect Jim Cooper, who were the first as well. What does this mean to you and how or will it shape how you lead the department? Or is it just a headline?
You know, it means a lot to me. And I really learned this in post-George Floyd, right? After George Floyd incident, a lot of things came out about policing, and I started getting hit up just saying, hey, not only are you in policing, but you also are a Black man, you know, and my perspective became very important for other people to hear how it is playing both sides. You know, we had a lot of criticisms, you know, after George Floyd, and I believe it's my responsibility to be an ethical officer, you know, regardless of what race I am, and to build a culture of inclusion with our communities and supportive of diversity in the department. You know, we should mirror the community we serve, and that's something we're working towards.
Given that there is this larger theme of diversity when it comes to the upper ranks that have historically been white and male, from your decades-long perspective in law enforcement, you know, going back to 1993, why do you think that's happening now?
Well, you know, I think it's just more intentional now to really we're understanding that you got diversity at the lower ranks, but to really have inclusivity, you really have to put people in positions of leadership roles as well.
You touched upon this, you know, when it comes to the city of Stockton, and this is an issue across the country and also in California, violent crime is up. Stockton has historically had some of the highest homicide and violent crime rates in our area. According to your department's statistics, in August of 2021, there were 28 homicides for the year so far. But this year so far, it's up. It's 39. Each city obviously has its own dynamics, its own challenges. But with just 4 months into this job, what is becoming apparent to you about Stockton and the challenges that you want to commit yourself to overcoming?
You know, I want to change the narrative for Stockton. Yes, it has its fair share of violence within the city, but there's also incredible things that happen in Stockton on a regular basis. I like to see the true measure of violent crime is those non-deadly encounters, you know, where folks aren't dying, but, you know, violence is happening along those lines. And we look at aggravated assaults where and our non-deadly shootings were down. We're also down in aggravated assaults. So that's two of the three, you know, statistical categories that we are doing better. And I think it's our partnerships, it's our ceasefire model, it's us all working together.
Yeah. I mean, you also said that you want to change the narrative of Stockton, you know, that Stockton gets a bad rap, you know, and you want to change that narrative from violent to vibrant. What is your role in changing this narrative for the better?
You know, I think I have a huge role, and it just starts with me being transparent and me being out at not only homicide scenes, I have to be out at the incredible events, you know, where it's things that we could really be proud of, that it involves our youth. I'm very passionate about youth, and, you know, we just need to make it intentional to get that narrative out there.
Yeah, I mean, you said this in the beginning of our conversation about being everyone's chief. You said that at your swearing-in ceremony. Where has law enforcement fell short when it comes to being everyone's chief, both within the department and throughout the community that it serves?
You know, I think it's two parts, right? Is you have to be everyone's chief internally. And I think that goes along the lines as organizational wellness. You know, if my rank and file do not feel well, I can't affect them to perform to our expectations, whether it's my expectations or the expectations of the community. So it's that internal procedural justice. It starts within where we value our people. We show we care about them, that we know that they're more than just a badge number, you know, that we also honor and champion the efforts of our support staff and professional staff. That starts internally. Then externally, we expand on that in our engagement with our communities, and we need the police and partner in the communities the way they see fit. You know, one community policing model isn't effective throughout the city. We have to do micro community policing models throughout the city.
Law enforcement retention is a big issue in recent years, and Stockton Police is included in this. You know, a simple drive through I-5 and you'll see other law enforcement agencies advertising better salaries out of town in the Bay Area. You lived in San Joaquin County or live in San Joaquin County. You commuted to San Jose to work with the police department. What are you working on in terms of retaining and recruiting officers to Stockton?
You know, you hit it right on. You know, my officers will never be the highest paid, but which means my leadership team and myself has to be on point in every other aspect of leadership. You know, we have to empower our people. We have to lead them. We have to develop them, train them. We have promotional opportunities at a higher rate that other agencies around us can't offer. We have more individuals on state and federal task forces that also our neighboring agencies can't do. So we do offer a lot of things. If, you know, people want to have a very proactive policing career and have the opportunity to work some very upscaled large crimes. So we got to partner with our ally agencies as well. And we are a larger department, so it's important that we work well with everyone. And it's important that we know our officers. You know, they have to know that we value them, that we understand they're doing more with less. And that'll help us with retaining. As far as recruiting, we've been doing a lot more. You know, we're partnering with athletic directors at the high school and college level to start those partnerships. You know, I think a lot of things translate well into policing that you get out of athletics. You know, as an athlete, you're held accountable. You know responsibility, accountability. You support the others on your team. You eat dinner with folks you may not have ever had dinner with if it wasn't for being on that team. And I think that translates well into policing. So we are robust in our recruiting athletes. Where we're partnering with military bases as well. We've shrunk the length of time from contact to completion. So we're taking a lot of proactive steps to really make us competitive when it comes to hiring.
Finally, we have you back on a year from now. What do you hope to report back to us about what's happening in Stockton under your leadership as chief?
You know, I want to report back that we're well, you know, that we're launching a crisis management unit internally so we can make sure our officers are well and focused on their assignments. You know, we're going to work to rebuild. We're going to build back better. You know, we have a lot of vacancies, and it's also an opportunity to really build back a strong agency, you know, and also we're going to work on crime reduction and that narrative. You know, hopefully when we Google Stockton next year, it's going to say vibrant.
Chief McFadden, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
And that is Chief Stanley McFadden, Stockton's new police chief. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Rachel Barton Pine has used her remarkable musical talent to connect with people all over the world. Described as an exciting, boundary-defying performer, Pine's versatility on the violin have helped her earn countless awards and frequent performances among some of the most renowned orchestras. Her powerful and evocative performances have even been featured on the big screen, including the award-winning 2018 film, The Favorite. Pine's next stop is here in Northern California, where she'll be performing with the Davis High School Baroque Ensemble this Friday. Joining us now is the virtuoso herself, along with Angelo Moreno, the orchestra director for Davis Senior High School. Rachel and Angelo, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Great to be here. I have to say, it was very poignant to fly into the Sacramento airport last night, being back in the area for the first time since the passing of my beloved friend and mentor, Michael Morgan.
Oh, yes. Wow. Yeah. That we are so happy to welcome you back to Northern California and Sacramento and Yolo County, no less. Angelo, I mean, you and your students must be so excited for what's going to take place on Friday.
Oh, we are absolutely buzzing this week for Rachel's arrival at Davis High School, for sure. We're so excited to have you, Rachel.
Rachel.
Well, this is my third time actually collaborating with Angelo and his students. Of course, it's a different crop of kids each time, and I can't wait to work with this batch. And this is actually something we were planning to have done in 2020.
Right, what happened?
Well, we ended up doing a layered video, which was a fun and interesting project. But of course, there's nothing like making music together in person. So this will be especially meaningful because we've been waiting for it for literally 2 years.
Rachel, given that this is going to be your third time, what keeps bringing you back to Davis?
Well, you know, Baroque violins are a whole different type of instrument than the modern violins that you normally hear. This is how violins initially existed in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s after they were first invented. They're strung with gut. The necks are a little different. The innards, the vibrating parts are a little different. It's a beautiful sound that I'm sure you've heard on the radio. You've heard on movie soundtracks. And it's, you know, something that kids don't often get a chance to experience until at least their college years. There are only two high school orchestras in the entire country that offer kids the opportunity to play this original kind of violin. And so it's so innovative that Angelo is doing that right here in Davis. And it's something that I've been passionate about since I was a teenager. And so it's really wonderful to have the chance to support this program and experience the kids' enthusiasm.
Angelo, that's incredible. What goes into such a rarity like a Baroque ensemble that Davis High School has?
Well, when I formed the group about 15 years ago, I had no idea I was creating the first Baroque ensemble of its kind at a public high school in the country. That was just a nice surprise. I just assumed this was the natural progression of orchestra programs. Davis High has three orchestras now, a full symphony orchestra, a chamber orchestra, and the Baroque ensemble. And this was like an extension for me, like a jazz band to a band program. But we did it the right way. We started with period style instruments. We own a beautiful John Phillips harpsichord. All the students are learning with Baroque bows. And now we get one of the world's greatest Baroque masters to work with for over 9 hours of coaching. I got to say, Rachel's incredibly gracious and kind and generous to, number one, come to Davis High and work with us, but then to spend so much time rehearsing with us and then donating all the proceeds of our concert to the students. Big tour to Europe this coming June. They're going to be going to England, Belgium, and France and doing over 6 concerts in beautiful cathedrals and historically significant venues. So thank you so much, Rachel.
What an experience. Wow. Rachel, it's not only you. Your daughter Sylvia is also going to be performing with you this Friday. What an amazing bond that the two of you share.
Yeah, there's no greater joy than making music with my own child. And she actually started Baroque violin when she was 7 years old. I think she's the only kid that age in the U.S. doing it, which is kind of fun. And now she just turned 11, and we're going to be doing a double concerto by Vivaldi. Of course, he's the famous guy that wrote the Four Seasons, and he wrote a couple of concertos for two violins. We'll be doing the one in A minor, which this last spring we did on our modern violins on a tour of four different cities in Israel with the Tel Aviv soloists. So it'll be nice to bring that to the type of violin that Vivaldi actually wrote it for. And it's actually historically accurate, more accurate for my daughter to be playing it than me, because Vivaldi wrote many of his concertos like this one for his own students who were at a girls' orphanage. And so literally all these great works by Vivaldi that we know and love were written for young girls to play.
Wow. I mean, just the parallel centuries and centuries later. I mean, I have a good hunch why Sylvia is your daughter is playing a violin. Where did your journey begin in all of this?
Well, I first encountered the violin when I was 3 years old, and some middle school age girls were playing violin in my church, and I just became obsessed with the sound of it, and I've never looked back. But I should mention, we keep talking about violins, but I'm actually not only playing the violin, but also a cousin of the violin in this particular performance. I'll be playing a 12-string instrument from the Baroque period called a viola d'amore. It has six playing strings and six resonating strings under them. I guess you could call it acoustic reverb. And this was an instrument that Vivaldi wrote numerous concertos for. Bach was a fan of this instrument. It's quite a finger twister to figure out where your fingers go on six different strings. I know guitarists do that all the time, but we bowed string players who play on the shoulder aren't quite so used to that challenge, and it definitely has you know, other types of issues than plucking. And so it's a real commitment to learn how to play the darn thing, but totally worth it because it has a voice which doesn't sound like any other instrument. It doesn't quite sound like a violin. It just has a silvery ringing kind of sound, and it's just so beautiful. And I can't wait to share that with everyone to show, you know, not that in the Baroque period, violinists didn't just play the violin. They also played this viola d'amore thing. And it's so super cool to have the chance to do that as well, and to show the audience, and especially to show the students.
Yeah, an experience that also transports you back into time, into history, which is wonderful. Let's take a quick listen to one of the songs that you'll be performing this week. Am I correct that you perform with a violin that is at least 240 years old?
Yeah, so ironically, my so-called modern violin is actually older than my Baroque violin. Of course, the violin that I have in modern setup would have been made in the Baroque period and then altered when violins changed their setup in the late 1700s, early 1800s. So my modern violin that, by the way, I'll be performing with on Sunday, doing the violin concerto number 2 by the great African-American woman composer Florence Price with the Berkeley Symphony. That will be my 1742 Guarneri del Gesu. But for this concert in Davis, I'll be using a 1770 Nicola Galliano, one of the great Italian makers. And actually, what's an extraordinary story is that I obtained this Galliano violin from London in the year 2001. And I obtained the Viola d'Amore that I'll be playing, which is also made by Galliano in New York in 2011. And by total coincidence, though I can tend to think it's less coincidence and maybe more fate, both instruments that were made by the same maker were actually made from the same tree. So it's a real reunion that they both survived and are now in the hands of the same player. And it's super amazing to have a matched set. Of course, they're both completely gorgeous, and I'm extremely lucky to have them.
As someone who's just dipping my toe into the Baroque period, I'm loving all the history but behind it. Finally, Angelo, you know, we only have about 20 or 30 seconds left. I'm sure people listening will want to attend. What do listeners need to know if they're interested in actually taking this in on Friday?
Yes, Friday night, it's going to be at the Davis High School Richard Brunell Performance Hall. And you can look it up on Facebook or on your website. We're going to start the performance with a pre-concert discussion with Rachel and Sylvia, and I'll be asking them some questions that I think the audience will be very much interested in, giving them a glimpse of how great these two folks are. And then we'll start the concert right after that. There'll be a shorter intermission. The concert runs about 90 minutes.
And it's free, right?
Free concert. We're accepting donations at the door. No tickets necessary.
You buried the lead. It's free, but donations to get your kids to Europe. Rachel Barton Pine is a concert violinist and joined by Angelo Moreno with Davis Senior High School's Baroque Ensemble. We have all of the information on our Insight page. That's Insight for today. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause. And rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.